Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are with you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Well, on Tuesday night, we went to Chelsea and came away with a point, but did anybody notice amid the furore of football trying to eat itself? Yes, the European Super League well and truly put the cat amongst the pigeons as the greedy six clubs built a house of cards that was soon toppled, with them now all trying to extricate themselves from the mess. As we try to make sense of it all, myself and Alan Wares are delighted to welcome back the Albion Deputy Chairman, Paul Barber. So, Paul, quiet week?
I've had quieter weeks, I think it's fair to say, AD, but, you know, hopefully all's well that ends well.
So, were you expecting this announcement? I mean, we all know, I guess, that, you know, that there is this move, the direction of travel towards this elitist, you know, sort of Super League in whatever form it was ever going to take. But when this announcement was first came out, slap bang in the middle, incidentally, of the FA's say no to racism, which I think was a bit of a cowardly move. Did you see it coming?
Well, I think, you know, to be honest, for the whole of the 25 years coming up that I've worked in professional football, this has always been something that has been lurking in the background and has often been used as a threat. You know, it's often been used as a tool for leverage against us. And, you know, at some point we knew that when the leverage ran out, there would be some kind of move to perhaps enact it. And, you know, we finally saw that over the weekend. When it came, it was a little bit of a surprise. The timing was a surprise. I mean, given that they've been looking at it for, you know, years and years and years, I thought the execution was poor, to say the least. But, you know, it was ill-timed, it was ill-judged. I think it shows a complete lack of understanding of football culture in this country. It shows a complete lack of understanding of what the fans actually want, a lack of understanding of what the fans know they're going to get, which is good times and bad times, and, you know, the complete rejection of permanent good times.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it before, though, where this has been muted, and it's been pretty much a smokescreen or a power grab, for want of a better phrase, to try and engineer more power within UEFA and within the Champions League. So, but this was this time it was actually serious.
Yeah, it was, and I think sometimes, you know, you can cry wolf once too often, can't you, before you actually have to deliver whatever it is you're threatening. And on this occasion, you know, they decided that they would deliver. And obviously the timing wasn't totally coincidental. UEFA were about to announce their reforms. You know, we're coming to the end of another season. TV contracts will soon be looked at again, domestically and internationally. You know, it wasn't a great surprise in that sense when you look at the context. But obviously, as I said, it was in other ways very ill-timed. You know, coming on the back of a period when we've had no fans in the stadium for more than a year, where people have had a very, very difficult time losing jobs, losing family members, losing hope in some cases, to come up with something quite as grotesque as this at a time like this just really underlines the lack of judgment.
I mean, the statement that was put out by the club on the day that the announcement was made, or it wasn't even really much of an announcement. It was kind of a leaking, and then we're going to do this, and everyone's going, what? You know, you could feel the rebellion in the air. You could feel the anger in the air. Now, the club's statement was excellent, very moderate, very well-toned, very diplomatic. But can you give us a flavour of, you know, the scenes within the club and the opinions and the attitude of your colleagues around you when you saw this, knowing full well that you can't actually call these people what you really want to call them?
Well, I think, you know, Tony and I both have a personality which is to sort of absorb before reacting. And I think sometimes you can react too quickly to situations before you fully understand the implications. And actually, you can be far more effective if you take a bit of time to understand the implications, think about them both for your own club, but also for the wider sport. And then your reaction and your statement is more considered. And, you know, we wanted to do two things. First of all, we wanted to fully understand what they were proposing, because information was coming out in dribs and drabs initially. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that we were aligned on our views, and it didn't take long for that to be established, to be honest. And then we wanted to make sure that our response was proportionate and reasonable and in line with the way our club operates. And, you know, I think, you know, we're always seen within Premier League meetings as being reasonable people who do things properly, who want the right thing for the club, but also the right thing for the game. And I think it's really important that we prepared our statement in that way.
OK, well Paul, you mentioned the Premier League meetings there, and these six clubs in this country, these are people you'd have been speaking to face to face, have good relationships on a personal basis and a professional basis. I mean, it's tantamount to industrial espionage, basically what they've done. I mean, how can you look them in the eye again with a straight face and take them seriously?
Well, in some cases, I've known these people for, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, I've certainly been in and around and involved with their clubs for that period, if not exactly the same people. And some of the actions and some of the behaviours we've seen in the last few days, I'm afraid, are entirely inconsistent with the values of those clubs as I've known them over that period. And that shocked me. But what I wasn't surprised about was the number of messages I was receiving from people that I know within those clubs who weren't the decision makers, but who are experienced football administrators and football people, who were shocked and alarmed and upset and distraught at the direction their own clubs were taking. And that actually reassured me that this wasn't going to happen, because on the one hand, yes, the owners are powerful, and obviously it's their business. They can take it in the direction that they think is appropriate. But when you are lacking support from your own staff, in some cases, your own managers and coaches and players, your sponsors, the media, the government, the royal family, the football family generally, I think you know that you're in a pretty bad place, a sticky wicket, AD, as you might say.
Yeah.
And from that point of view, you know, to be honest, it actually reassured me that the position that we, Tony and I, had agreed and that our board supported and I knew our staff would support was absolutely the right one. And we just had to make sure our timing in response was right. We wanted Graham and the players to focus on the game at Chelsea. So we didn't want Graham embroiled in a press conference that was all about European Super League. So, you know, we basically allow Graham, if you like, to sidestep the questions and asked him to just focus on the game, which he absolutely did, as you know. And then we made sure our statement went out at the time that we were meeting as clubs, so that people were in no doubt before we went into the meeting and during the meeting what our club's position was. And obviously during the meeting itself, we were able to put that point of view across.
I mean, I've got to say this, but I mean, I don't know if it's unprecedented or not, but, you know, the Premier League, a lot of people don't realise that the Premier League is its members. And so to have a meeting where a third of the membership is not invited, that's surely unprecedented. So, you know, one, can you give us a flavour of the mood of the meeting? And two, was there anyone out there, you know, whether it was the Albion or whether it was, you know, Everton, who were obviously very upset, who were the kind of the mood leaders? I mean, were there leaders and followers in there, or was everyone pretty much on the same page?
No, I would say it was one of the few Premier League meetings that, you know, I've attended, albeit with six clubs missing, where everyone's mood was totally aligned. Everyone was angry. Everyone was disappointed. Everyone was feeling let down, to be honest, by the six clubs. You know, what a lot of people won't know, because it's not made particularly public, is that, you know, in addition to being equal shareholders in the Premier League, we all share a number of responsibilities for different aspects of the running of the Premier League. So there's a series of different committees, and club representatives are elected onto or appointed onto those committees. And they're pretty important committees, because they determine the commercial direction of the league. They determine the broadcast direction. They determine the governance direction. They determine the disciplinary direction. And in a lot of cases, some of us have been sitting on those committees for a number of years now, alongside people that certainly in the last year, I would say, have been plotting against us. And that feels very, very uncomfortable. And it feels quite debilitating, actually, because like anything else, you go into things trusting people, trusting their reputations, trusting their professionalism, trusting their integrity. and trusting their motives. And on this occasion, certainly the committees I sat on, I feel that I've been personally let down, and our football club's been let down, Premier League's been let down, and the game as a whole has been let down. And that's something which I won't forget in a hurry.
So it's a sense of betrayal, basically.
It is. And I think you, as I say, maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm too trusting of my colleagues. I certainly will be a little bit more guarded going forward, that's for sure. But I've been in this business a long time, and I've known a lot of these people a long time, and I've never had reason before to doubt motives. We've all got different objectives within our businesses, and we've got to understand a little bit that the biggest six clubs have got quite significantly different objectives as a business than we have, and they've got significantly different owners' objectives as well. And I respect that, because every business has a right to develop and push and flourish in its own way. But we're a little bit different than a lot of businesses, because we exist within an ecosystem that actually has to flourish as an ecosystem in its entirety. We can't have a small number of clubs flourishing to the detriment of everybody else, because otherwise the ecosystem will collapse. Yeah. And unfortunately, what this was about was effectively about creating a concentrated amount of wealth within a very small number of clubs to the detriment of everyone else. I mean, if I tell you that, over the last year, the 12 clubs in the ESL have actually generated more than 30% of the total revenue of the other 700 clubs. So, put that into numbers, those 12 clubs have generated around 6 billion euros over the last 12 months. 700 other clubs playing in European football have generated around 15 billion euros.
And so is that in COVID times as well?
Absolutely. So sorry, that will be the year before COVID. Sorry, okay. Let's get that right. So actually what you've got there, you've already got the 12 richest clubs in Europe generating more than 30% of the entire revenue of the football industry. And what they were proposing was to put themselves in a position where they generated even more to the detriment of everybody else. That would have actually done two things. First of all, it would have actually clearly given them a significant advantage over the rest of us in our domestic competitions. And secondly, over a period of time, because their European competition would have become the primary competition for them, it would have actually eroded the value in our domestic competitions, therefore making us even poorer. So the actual outcome of this was quite simply to create a gap that was not only large, but it was gargantuan and almost unbridgeable for everybody. And of course, what that then does is it then guarantees your success in your domestic league. It means that you then push the agenda for broadcasters and sponsors onto a completely different platform, i.e. European Super League, and then all of the other domestic leagues across Europe and the leagues that support them in the pyramids then start to disintegrate. And anyone that gets seduced by the idea is, oh, don't worry, because we were going to set aside a sum of money called solidarity that we would pass down through the pyramids. Anyone that's seduced by that idea as being a sustainable one that's going to keep all, in our case, 92 clubs in the English professional system intact as they are at the moment, is absolutely kidding themselves. And unfortunately, I think for the 12, not only did people see through that very quickly and the nonsense around a European Super League for the women's game, and let's get our domestic women's leagues established before we worry about a European Super League for women's football. But anyone that actually didn't see that this was a power grab, a concentration of wealth, a guarantee of taking away progress on the field by merit, actually just simply guaranteeing a small number of clubs a very large amount of money, again, needs to wake up and smell the coffee, because that's exactly what it was.
And this isn't the first time it's happened this season, is it? I mean, you've had an attempt at a domestic power grab that you've had to put up with. I mean, you didn't sign up for this, did you?
Well, not only did we not sign up for this, but again, the owners of these 12 clubs knew what they were signing up to themselves. They knew that there was jeopardy in English or European football. They knew that there was promotion and relegation. They knew that there would be years when they wouldn't be in a top four position or a top seven position, and European competition may not be their right in that season. They knew that there were ebbs and flows in professional sport. And yet, having got in on that basis, they now want to change it and therefore change the entire culture of what we've all grown up to love. And let's be very clear as well. This isn't a perfect system that we have. This isn't a nirvana that we have at the moment. We know that there are faults within the system. We know that there are things that we need to address, but this isn't the way to do it.
Yeah. Well, and you said it yourself before. Other people have said it before, and it's been said up and down the country, particularly this week, that the owners of these clubs, they're just the temporary custodians of hundreds of years of history, and you know, and they're trying to erode that history in one fell swoop, and it just sucks. It really does.
Well, Paul, just before you, I just want to add to that point is that being an owner of a football club, and I've got to say this from a fan's point of view, and I do include Tony Bloom in this, but I think Tony Bloom does actually recognise the importance of the privileged role that he has. Is that yes, he's the custodian, but he's one with the heart and the head in the right place. And this is the point that drives me around the twist. We're talking about Florentino Perez, we're talking about Andrea Agnelli, we're talking about all the various owners of these large European clubs who have no concept of football. And you think, well, yeah, it's not necessarily the case that an owner should be an ex-footballer. Of course, it doesn't work that way. But dear God, where was the due diligence given the speed of the collapse of the European Super League within, 36 hours of it being announced? Where was the due diligence from the owners of not realising just how badly this would play out?
Well, that's the $3.5 billion question or whatever they were going to raise. it really is quite mind-boggling, really, that you get yourself into this situation where I think where there are 12 clubs who believe they've got a common goal and similar problems, they start to form what I can only describe as an echo chamber. So you tell each other your problems. Those problems come back to you from the others. So you believe that you've all got the same problems. You then put out a solution. Everybody says that's a great solution. That will solve all of our problems. And then in a vacuum, you decide that everybody else will see things your way and the same way. And if you then add on a layer of a lack of understanding of the culture of football in this country, let alone in the other countries involved, then you've got a recipe for the PR catastrophe that they created. Because actually you're believing that your solution to what you consider to be everyone's problems is the right one, and that everybody else will simply say, my God, these guys have got it so right. They're geniuses. They're going to solve all of our problems as well. And of course, when you come out of your echo chamber and you announce your great idea and it gets met with the kind of reaction that this got met with, it's a bit of a shock to the system. And I don't think that they could possibly have imagined that the reaction was going to be anything like this. Because if they did, then they wouldn't have done it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And the thing is, I mean, it does seem to have come. I mean, obviously, it was a JP Morgan behind it and a lot of the Americans behind it. Obviously, we're going to talk about the German model in a second. But, I mean, the people at the clubs, the staff, the managers, the players, they didn't want this. They didn't tell anyone. They didn't tell their colleagues like yourselves about this. I mean, it's just like a secret little party, which you're not invited to.
Well, I mean, I deliberately used the word in our statement, clandestine meetings, because that's what they were. And for me, any kind of clandestine meeting has got some degree of
cynicism
deceit to it. Yeah, there's a reason for it being clandestine, and you know, I suppose from that point of view, you know, it underlines how disappointed we all were, because you know, the one thing about the Premier League that is good, and as I said before, not everything's perfect by any means, is that we do have an equal shareholding. Even as Brighton Hove Albion in our fourth season in the Premier League, we have as much right around the table and as much voting power as any of the other clubs that have been there since its inception. And that's actually really quite a powerful thing if you think about it. And, you know, one of the things I've still got in my office from the day that we joined the Premier League is our share certificate. And you only give that share certificate back, obviously, when you leave the league. But I'm really proud of that on behalf of the club, of holding that. And I'm really proud for a couple of reasons. One, because we got there, and that's fantastic in itself. But also, it demonstrates that we've got an equal voice at the top of the English pyramid. And that's something which every Brighton fan, every Brighton staff member and director can be really proud of, and players and coaches, because that's what we've all strived for. So when we hold that, I think it's really important, and Tony and I 100% agree on this, that we exercise our equal shareholding in absolutely the right way all the time. And when things are right for the league, we absolutely vote in favour. But when things are not right for the league at all, or not right for our club, then we vote against. And, you know, we see our responsibilities in three tiers. First of all, it's our club. Then it's the league in which we're operating in, the Premier League in this case. And then it's football as a whole. On this occasion, it was very much almost an inverse reaction. Football as a whole had to be put first.
The thing is, a cynic might just say, and we see a lot of it on Twitter from those sort of holier-than-thou fans of the Big Six, and there are a few of them still left, you know, that, well, who are Brighton? They wouldn't have got invited anyway. But, you know, it's not the case that, you know, the Tony that we know and love, and the Paul that we've come to know and respect, you wouldn't have joined anyway, would you?
No, I can categorically say, Al, that 100% that Tony and I would both instinctively both said that we wouldn't have even joined if invited. You know, it's not good for football. It's not right for football. And as I've said before, you know, I think it's really important in these decisions that you look at not just your own club, but you look at the ecosystem that you're part of. And we're part of an ecosystem that we love, that we want to protect, we want to nourish and nurture. And it's really important in these sort of situations you make the right decision for the game as well as for your own club. But it was one of those occasions where football absolutely had to come first, because if it didn't, then frankly, Premier League, Brighton Hove Albion, any other club probably wouldn't be around for too long anyway.
It's just something that, again, it's along the personal lines, Paul, is that we played Chelsea on Tuesday, and of course at that time there was this maelstrom going on. There was a the protest by the fans who came out into the streets. They're in lying one positive argument for a football club being in the middle of its streets rather than out in the countryside. I'd like to think that if the boot was on the other foot, we could actually go out to the Amex and protested. But there was 1,000 people turned up at Stamford Bridge. You guys are in the middle of it as chief executive, as manager, as players. You were delayed kickoff and what have you. Can you give us an idea of a flavour? Bearing in mind, it was such a rapidly changing story that evening from before kickoff to after the final whistle. Give us an idea as to how it was for you on behalf of the club and also just watching the whole event unravel.
Sure. Well, first of all, I didn't actually get away from Brighton until about 3:30, quarter to four on that day, just simply because the amount of meetings and calls that were going on just kept delaying me leaving. I normally get to the team hotel for an away game and then travelling on the bus, particularly during COVID times. I wasn't able to do that, so I couldn't get to the team hotel in time. So I abandoned my car just on the other side of Vauxhall Bridge, jumped in a cab. By then, our head of security had advised me that there was going to be a protest at Chelsea. And I think, to be honest, 80,000 people is quite a conservative number by the time I got there. And to give you some idea, the taxi got me to Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. So those of you that know that area, you know, it's a little way from Stamford Bridge from there. And I had to get out because by then the police were closing off the road. The numbers of people protesting outside the stadium had got to a level where the road couldn't operate. On the other side of the stadium, Fulham Broadway side, the team bus was stuck, couldn't get through the crowds in the road. Again, I got another call from our head of security to say, Paul, we've got a problem. We're not going to get in before our normal arrival time, which is 90 minutes before kickoff. Usually that means you suffer Premier League sanctions for that. And that's something you want to avoid because it's costly. And then I had a challenge myself of getting into the stadium because I couldn't get through the crowds who by then were getting fairly lively. And there was a lot of media, camera crews, photographers. It was quite a lively scene. But eventually I managed to get a steward's attention, managed to show my staff badge, got let through various cordons, temperature checks, all the usual stuff to get into a stadium these days. And then found myself in reception. But by now it was just coming up to 7 o'clock and the team still weren't at the stadium. So we had a problem because we were kicking off in 60 minutes. And we had no team there. So, you know, as much as I might have fancied myself 30 years ago, you know, it wasn't a game that I was likely to win on my own 30 years after my prime. So anyway, you know, we were obviously in communication with our team security. We'd spoken to the Premier League. As it turned out, Chelsea was struggling to get into the stadium as well. So we had a legitimate reason to delay the kickoff, and we eventually got the Premier League to agree to that. But in the meantime, I've been asked by Sky to do a pitch side interview, which I did. And as Paul Camlin, I think, has related on the club's website, and he put the interview on there. By the time I'd completed this interview with Sky, which was recorded as live, so it was due to be dropped into the programme as the game build-up continued, by the time I'd done the interview and got back round to the other side of the stadium and the boardroom, events had moved so far that Sky couldn't use the interview because it was out of date. And I'd actually only finished it less than 5 minutes earlier. So to give you an idea of how fast moving the story was, obviously I met the Chelsea chairman. We talked about the situation. We talked about the problems outside. By this time, Peter Cech had gone outside to try and calm the fans down. Unfortunately, because he didn't condemn the European Super League, it had the opposite effect. So by now that the fans were, you know, getting quite lively. Our team had by this time just about got into the stadium, and we were preparing for the game as best we could. So, you know, in all honesty, it was the most surreal. I mean, I think now I've been involved in just over 1,000 first team games, whether it's been in at Brighton, at Tottenham, in Vancouver, or with England. And I've never, ever been in a situation as surreal as that. You've got an empty stadium. You've got thousands of fans outside. You've got as many police outside as you'd have on a normal match day, but this isn't a normal match day.
Helicopters.
You've got helicopters overhead. You've got an interview that I've done as live, but 5 minutes later is out of date and they can't use it. You've got the Chelsea chairman who is on the phone constantly, presumably to his owner. You've got other directors and staff running around. So you get a sense that this isn't going to be long, or Chelsea aren't going to be long in this European Super League at this point. And then, by the way, oh, the game's kicked off we need something from it. So, you know, I don't know whether I've given you a picture there, Al, but that was what it was like.
What I wanted to ask was that, you know, with the protest that you know that held you up, with hindsight, or maybe even you thought about it at the time, how important, how key was that protest to the events that later happened? I mean, did you actually have a feeling at the time thinking, yes, you know, this is, at least, you know, we're in agreement here. They're Chelsea fans, they're Brighton fans. We're all against this. Or did you have a concern about it?
I thought it was really significant. And I said it to the media yesterday. For me, I had a real sense that the fans clearly didn't want this. I mean, you only had to go switch on the TV during the day to see, you know, the protests at Leeds and the protests at Liverpool and the protests wherever, you know, whichever stadium the cameras happen to be at. But when you turn up and you see that number of people and the strength of feeling, and actually the police, I've got to say, handled it very, very well, because they made it very clear they were going to allow the protests, and the Chelsea fans were, you know, good. They didn't do anything that they weren't supposed to do or the police asked them not to do. So the whole thing was controlled, but it was vociferous, and it was very, very clear to anyone from any football club, Chelsea or Brighton, that these people did not want this to go ahead. And by the way, this was their club. This was a club that they support. And for me, the most striking thing about this whole last 72 hours is that the fans of those clubs who arguably stood to gain not just most, but everything, absolutely and fundamentally opposed it to a man, to a woman. And that, to me, was the most powerful demonstration I've seen of a united fans action in a very, very condensed period of time. And this club has got a great history of fans action making change happen. But on this scale, this quickly, with some of the most powerful clubs in the world, I thought was remarkable and quite humbling, actually, because there was very little that I could say or any of us could say that was going to have as much powerful effect as that.
So you were talking to Bruce Buck. I mean, what was the temperature of that conversation?
Well, Bruce and I have known each other a long time, and you know, we get on well. You know, Bruce is a very, articulate, erudite, intelligent man. And, you know, Chelsea are a very good football club. But he knew that my feelings on this were not the same as his, shall we say. You know, I think it was fair to say it's one of those conversations that there's no point in pursuing your own respective opinions because they're so different that you're only ever going to end up in an agreement to disagree. But in fairness, you know, Bruce by this time, you know, was clearly preoccupied with other things. And, you know, it started to emerge, I think, even before kickoff that Chelsea were likely to be withdrawing. And it was obvious from the amount of movement of their staff around the chairman and his directors that there was something going on. And in these situations, to be honest, my view is, you know, let it happen. You know, you don't need to do anything, you know, just sit back, watch the game, let them do whatever they've got to do. And, you know, I was getting updates from journalists and from people that I know in the game who were saying it's wobbling at Manchester City, it's wobbling at Tottenham, it's wobbling here, it's wobbling there. And, you know, it's one of those where you felt, well, probably by the end of tonight, if not by the end of tomorrow, this thing is probably going to be dead. And so it proved.
Yeah, and the house of cards toppled very, very, very quickly. And, you know, okay, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. The show is, as ever, brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has given us yet another shirt of the week for our delight. And Al, can you have a look at this one for me and describe it for me? It's really nice, actually. I like it.
Yeah, it's this funny thing about diagonal stripes. I know they're kind of very popular in polo, the way that hoops are in rugby and what have you. So what we've got is a white shirt with a black diagonal stripe. Everything about it screams Botafogo, but I can clearly see it's not because the badge, partially photoshopped, says something football club. There's an orange advertiser across the chest, Hutchinson Network. It's made by Joma, J-O-M-A. And there's a couple of idents on the sleeve. Now, I'm going to have a stabbed wild guess here that this is a League Two side in England. And seeing as I don't have any idea whatsoever, I'm going to go for Harrogate Town.
Well, you're right by saying it's a League Two side.
I know, because it's this on the sleeve.
But not in this country.
Is that a Ligue 2?
No, I shall tell you, this is what Phil says. Here is your shirt of the week. This is the 2016 to 2017 home shirt of Scottish League Two side, Edinburgh City. They go by the nickname of the Citizens, and they currently play at the 3,534 capacity Ainslie Park Stadium, which they share with Lowland League side Spartans. This is while they wait for the council to refurbish their proper home, the Meadowbank Stadium, which was vacated by Meadowbank Thistle when they moved to Livingston and became known as Livingston FC. Edinburgh City were originally formed in 1928, but folded in 1958. A new team was founded under the name of Postal United in 1966. They played in the Scottish non-leagues. The Edinburgh City Football Club Limited, which has continued trading as a social club since the football club stopped playing, gave their approval in 1986 for Postal United to use the Edinburgh City name. The club climbed the non-leagues and won the Lowland League title in 2015 and 2016. They were promoted to the Scottish Professional League by beating East Stirlingshire in a playoff match, and the first time that a non-league club had ever been promoted to the Professional League. Up until that point, the only way to get into the league was by way of election. For an example, a professional team that went out of business, i.e. Annan Athletic, they joined the league after the demise of Gretna in 2008. They play in black and white, which is regarded the colours of the city, and are currently managed by Gary Naismith, who played most of his career in England with Everton, Sheffield United and Huddersfield. The most notable, just about, former player we can find is former West Brom and Celtic journeyman Craig Beattie, who even turned out for the bad smell up the road 15 times in 2008.
Silly boy.
So thanks for that, Phil. That's
the funny thing. I mean, it just occurred to me while you were reading that out. Apart from London, which probably doesn't bear the name of a football team, I reckon Edinburgh City must be the lowest ranked football club in Europe that bears the Capitals title?
Possibly.
Because even in Madrid, Manchester? Sorry?
Manchester United and Manchester City?
Well, that's not a capital, is it?
Oh, not a capital. Well, London does actually, is named currently on the West Ham's badge.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And they play at the London Stadium.
Let's not go down too far. But if you're talking about their official name, I can't think of a capital city. I mean, obviously there's Hearts and there's Hibs within Edinburgh, but they don't bear the city's name. It's just one of those things I just thought of considering, thinking, you know, is there a capital city that has its main football team bearing its name being so lowly?
Yeah, well,
answers over there because I don't really care anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, if Glasgow was the capital, then it would be Glasgow Celtic and Glasgow Rangers. But
neither Glasgow Celtic nor Glasgow Rangers are their official titles. They are genuinely just Rangers and Celtic. Yeah, no, exactly.
So, there you go, fact fans. And they weren't they weren't asked to join the Super League either.
Good. The thing is, Paul, this isn't over, is it? Because, you know, with something like this, which as Graeme Souness was more than happy to go banging on about on several occasions, was that, you know, this is several months in the making. You know, as you say, clandestine meetings, you know, the deceit and the fundamental dishonesty of people not being able to look you in the eye and say, hey, we've got intention of doing this. Is there still the fire within the people who are so upset with, you know, the other 14 who are so upset with what's going on here about the level of sanction, the appropriate level of sanction that could or should be meted out either on the clubs or the individuals or, you know, the group, the cartel itself. So I'm just thinking, I'm just asking you about what your thoughts are and maybe what the other 14 clubs' thoughts are on how sanctions can be implemented should you wish to do any.
Well, first of all, all of us that work in football, from the coaches and players right the way through the directors and staff, we all understand that we work within a regulatory environment. So we all sign up in our basic staff contracts to abide by football's regulations. And we also understand that if at any point we breach those regulations, either as a club or individually, then we're subject to sanctions. So what needs to happen now and what is happening now, literally now, is that the Premier League and the Football Association are reviewing all of the actions of all of the individuals and clubs involved. They will assess those actions against their regulations. And if they find breaches, then there will be sanctions. The one thing I've been really careful on over the last 24 hours to make clear from our point of view is that it's really important if there are sanctions that they're directed at the right people. Because when you start talking about points deductions, yes, of course, it hurts the club. But more than anything, it hurts the people at those clubs who have had nothing to do with this. You know, the staff, the players, the coaches, the supporters, you know, they are not the reason that these clubs were planning to break away into European Super League, but they would be the biggest victims of a points deduction. You know, financial penalties are obviously significant. Potential suspensions from operating within the game are well within the FA's powers if they go down that route. But I think it's really important that we separate out the sanctions from the clubs to some extent, because otherwise you're in danger of punishing the wrong people.
I mean, you could argue, though, Paul, though, that, I mean, obviously, we've seen clubs up and down the country go into administration and get docked 15 points or 20 points, whatever the going rate for going into administration is. And that's not the fault of the players or the non-match day staff. But you
that's a fair point, Aidy, and that is certainly a fair point. But those clubs who do go into administration are usually very aware of what they're doing. So many staff members will be aware of the numbers, aware of the contracts that are being committed to, aware of the general situation of the club at any given point in time. There are exceptions, of course, there are to that. But on this occasion, we're talking here about a very, very, very small number of people that were leading something that in many cases some of their own directors probably were not even aware of. So again, I think it's difficult because inevitably when you issue sanctions of any kind, there's always unfortunately some collateral damage. Of course there is. But I just think we've got to be really careful, because I know for a fact that there were many, many staff members at each one of those six clubs who were as horrified as the three of us about what was happening, but were absolutely powerless to do anything about it and knew nothing about it to start with. So, you know, they, for example, if you deduct points, could find themselves relegated and losing their jobs or having their pay cut in half or whatever it happened to be through absolutely no fault of their own. And I'm not a great believer in punishments that hurt innocent people. And that is something which...
Sorry, Paul, I have to cut across you here. I do get that. I do understand your point here. And then if there could be this surgical sanction incision on getting to the right people, but for far too long, far too often, rightly or wrongly, within football, and we can actually talk about us 24 years ago when we got 2 points docked. Now it's for pitch invasions. But it was on the back of we felt the FA and the Football League not doing anything to help our cause. What I'm saying is there's precedence here. And if you're going to have one set of punishments for smaller clubs who have 10 points docked because of administrative irregularities, because of financial irregularities or whatever it might be, which is, as Adi's pointing out, is not the fault of the players or the fans or the people who are central to a football club. You have to then look at applying those same stiff sanctions. And let's face it, there's a disproportionate sting when it was Macclesfield, when it was Bury, when it was Luton, when it was even possibly Leeds and Southampton, you know, when it was them. They got done for it, and the fans suffered for something that wasn't their fault. All I'd say to you is that consider precedence, or, you do risk running into, once again, one rule for one and one rule for the other.
Well, yeah, I get that. And I'm not trying to defend this in any way, shape or form. But I think in all of the cases you've mentioned, those sanctions were written in black and white for those rule breaches. And therefore, there is a breach, and then there's a tariff. And that's very clear to everyone. Mm-hmm. This is a situation where there is no tariff for this type of behaviour. So those that are responsible for assessing whether rules have been broken and regulations have been breached have actually got quite a difficult job, because they don't actually have a script for how you deal with this situation. Because actually, even back in 1992, when the Premier League was formed, it was a breakaway with consent. It's actually with the FA's consent that the breakaway happened. So at that time, no regulations were breached, no rules were broken. There were no sanctions because there were no breaches. In this scenario, it's very, very different. And there is no precedent. There are precedents for different rule breaches and for different situations. And I absolutely take your point. And I'm not totally in favour of those either, by the way. In this situation, it is quite different. The good thing, we're not the judge, we're not the jury, we're not the investigators. People with far better brains, bigger brains than mine have got to get their heads around what happened, how it happened, who was responsible, what they need to do to ensure that there are some sanctions. We've already seen in the last 24 hours the Premier League have acted to remove all of the people that were on the committees I described earlier from those big clubs, and they've taken them off the committees, asked them to resign, or they will remove them. That is an immediate sanction of a kind. Clearly, that doesn't hurt the fans, doesn't hurt the staff, but it's pretty humiliating for the individuals involved. And that's a start. But the investigation is a serious one, and it involves, both the judicial areas of both the Premier League and the FA. And, we're talking very highly qualified legal minds here that will look at that. So we'll leave that to them. All we can do is look to where we go from here and to ensure that this doesn't happen again. And that's where we can have an influence.
Well, hypothetically, in that case, and it is a what-if scenario, which might be difficult to answer. How would you feel if, after whatever it is that's been done, that these people were allowed to continue in the roles that they are currently in?
Well, again, the one thing I always close down really quickly, whether it's our own fans or people on the outside, is when people start telling me how to discipline my staff or what I should do with this person because they did this and not that. It's really for those clubs, I think, Al, to look at the conduct of their people and decide whether it was appropriate, whether it was within their own staff codes of conduct, breaches of terms and conditions of their employment, and whether there's been any breaches. That's for them. It's also then for the football authorities, because the one thing the FA does have at its disposal is a bring a game into disrepute charge, which gets levelled at anybody in the game who has literally brought the game into disrepute. And those sanctions for a charge of that kind are really far reaching. They can involve anything from personal financial penalties, club financial penalties, right the way to suspension from the game. And if I'm suspended from the game, my contract says I don't get paid. So, you know, ultimately I would probably be fired, in all honesty, in my position. So, and I would expect to be if I've done something so bad that I've got to be suspended from the game. So, you know, again, the FA has got a lot of power here. How it uses it, whether it can justify it based on the information it gathers, remains to be seen. But, you know, it's going to be a very, very interesting few weeks and months, I think, because this thing, you know, is not going to be investigated super quickly because it's highly complex.
Now, I have seen many, many instances of the FA bringing the game into disrepute over the years, and nothing matches this.
Oh, yeah.
They've tried to kill
football. We tried it with Bill Archer, didn't we? You know, we tried to get that, and, you know, the thing is, I think that the point is, as Paul says, is that we've got to let, you know, the situation run its course.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, like I said, there is a kind of a united condemnation of what's happened here. I mean, these however many people it is, 6, 8, 10, 12 people, how many are involved at each club, they know they are pariahs at the moment. And are probably, you know, their adrenaline is turning brown right now. But
their positions are untenable.
Well, yes, but, you know, like I say, as Paul said, it's the case that you can't tell Manchester United who they can and can't hire and fire. It's just, you know, their name will be dirt after it, which is a different matter. But in the great scheme of things, Paul, when I said this isn't over, because this thing has been sort of mooted around for about 25 years or, you know, even before that, do you fear that this thing will rear its head again?
Well, this is where, you know, I started to say at the end of that last answer that where we do have some influence and where we do have a relative amount of power is in shaping regulations going forward. And they can be shaped at Premier League level, which is where we do have some power as an equal shareholder. And they can be shaped at the FA's level as well, where the FA have the ultimate power as a governing body in England. So I know that those two organisations are already working alongside government in some cases to see what they can do within their regulations to make sure that this can't happen again. And if it does, going back to the earlier point, there are clear sanctions. So you do this, this is what happens. That doesn't exist, as far as I'm aware, at the moment. And that in itself would be a massive step forward to protect us in the future. Do I think that this problem is going to go away? No, I don't, because, as I said before, every owner of every business has a right to generate the highest revenues they can for that business, because that's how they get a return on their investment. But what we need to make sure is there is a very, very strong and robust framework around it when it concerns football, so that they can't harm the rest of the sport in doing that, in pursuing that. And that's something which maybe the one very good thing to come out of this episode will give us is that it gives us even greater protection than we've ever had. And it's a bit like, you know, installing a fire alarm after you've just had that small fire in the kitchen that you just, thank God, it didn't get a lot worse before you caught it. This may well have been that moment when, you know, not only have we caught the fire before it got bad, but we've installed a great fire safety system and an alarm system and a smoke detector system to protect us for the future.
Absolutely. Now, Paul, I think this is going to run for a little bit longer, and there's certainly a lot of bridges to be rebuilt with some of those clubs, and lots of trust issues which you're going to have to deal with. But I think we're going to talk about that another day. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. The show is brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Now, Paul, on Tuesday night, there was a small matter of a football match going on, and wouldn't it be a whole lot sweeter if Danny Welbeck's shot hadn't hit the post?
Yeah, I'm actually applying for a patent to redesign goalposts in only for our games and only when we're attacking. I don't know how many times this season that we've hit the post. I mean, starting with Manchester United, didn't it, at the Amex, where I think we hit the post
five
times. And there have been numerous examples since, including the penalty at West Brom. I mean, you know, it's one of those frustrating moments, but Danny did everything right and, you know, but put the ball in the net. And unfortunately, you know, we've had so many examples this season where our performances haven't got the reward that they deserve by way of points. But, you know, a point at Chelsea, at Stamford Bridge, when Chelsea, you know, forget the West Brom game, that was an aberration. Since Tuchel took charge, Chelsea have been in excellent form. And I thought for the first 20 minutes on Tuesday, they were excellent. And, you know, we were having to really work hard to get a foothold in the game. And we did. And I thought certainly in the last 20 minutes, 25 minutes, we were probably the better side and looked the more likely to win it. I know that Giroud had his shot that went narrowly wide. But the sort of the sense of unease amongst my colleagues from Chelsea on the right-hand side of me for the last 20 minutes gave me a real good sense that we were, you know, we were doing well in that game. And so coming away with a point, another clean sheet, it's another point towards, you know, where we want to be. And the job's not done by any means, but, you know, we've got a great platform going into the last half dozen games now where, you know, we can secure our position again and move forward again for next season.
I mean, it is. I mean, like you said, I mean, we've left too many points out of the pitch this season, and it has been frustrating. But I mean, we're certainly seeing an awful lot of progress on the pitch. We're certainly delighted in the measure of performances. Now, obviously,
in that case, in mentioning that, AD, I'm almost embarrassed to ask it, and I'll take it out if I have to. But the Daily Mail reporting about, I don't know, 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, that Tony Bloom wants to have a good strong word with Graham Potter at the end of the season about our position in the table. It's a vintage.
You stop you there, Al. It was complete and utter nonsense.
Yeah.
We figured.
And it is the Daily Mail, don't get me wrong. It's just that story seems to be gaining traction amongst other people as well. So
complete and utter nonsense. Yeah. And there's only two people, or possibly three, that would have any inclination of what our conversations with any of our senior staff are. And that's myself, Tony and Dan in Graham's case. Mm. And in most cases, it'd only be Tony and myself. Yeah. And I can absolutely assure everyone there is absolutely no truth in that story whatsoever. Zero.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, the question I was going to ask, Al, was that obviously because I mean, let's face it, Fulham kind of needs snookers at the moment. And I mean, I can see us winning at least another game between now and the end of the season, which will secure a record fifth season in the top flight for us. Now, obviously, times have been tough. It's COVID. The revenues haven't been coming through for the match day. And obviously, there's probably certain recompenses you've had to make to certain sponsors, etc.
Can we afford a striker?
basically are we in a position where our commodities, which we have got a lot of at the moment, may have to be, we may need to make some money somewhere?
Well, every summer you look at the squad and talk to Graham obviously and Dan, and you know, we come up with a plan to decide what we're going to do with the squad, and that, you know, always involves a degree of trimming, always. And it really does depend on this market this summer as to how we do that. You know, it's a very, very different market to anything we've ever experienced. This is actually even more different to last summer's market, which was weird enough. And that's because the true effect of COVID now is actually being felt over two seasons. You know, we booked an additional loss of around 25 million on the cost of COVID last season. This season, it won't be far off, if not broadly similar. So over the course of two seasons, you know, Tony's had to cover a hole of £50 million plus. That's a huge amount of money for any one individual to have to cover. And, you know, that's just the start of it. You know, all the while, of course, we've been fully paying our staff. And in a lot of cases, obviously, to work from home. And that's been difficult. We haven't furloughed anyone in the football club. We haven't taken any government loans. We've not benefited from the 0.5% interest rate that some of our Premier League clubs, fellow clubs have benefited from in government loans. We haven't been able to, you know, basically generate any grant funding from as a result of COVID. We've played everything by the book and looked after our people and done whatever we can. So, you know, and we're actually proud of that. We haven't got anything on our consciences to worry about that we've taken advantage of anyone or anything during this period. And I'd hope the opposite, that we've tried to help wherever we can. So going into the transfer market, we will do what we can, how we can, where we can, when we can. As always, the market is going to be the market. This one is going to be very unpredictable because every bone in my body says that volumes will probably be down. People won't have as much money as normal. That means if people want to buy our players, they may not reach the values that we have for them if we want to sell them. We may not want to reach the values that other people have. Loan deals may become more important. But having said all of that, at the top end of the market, in the whole of the 25 years that I've been in football, I've never seen anything affect the top end of the market. The biggest clubs will get the best players on the transfer fees that are appropriate and on the wages that those players demand. And that always has some degree of trickle down through the system. What I don't know about this one is what the volumes will be and whether that appetite will still be there. My gut tells me it will be because it never hasn't been, but it really is an unknown.
I mean, I think actually, and for any prospective players who are looking at coming to Brighton, they were seeing the style of play, what Graham has brought to the team, the way he's bringing players through from the academy. It's an attractive proposition. We're an attractive proposition to anyone, and they will see that what we're needing is just something a little bit more at the sharp end to put away a lot of these chances. I mean, you know, we would have been in the European Champions League on XG, I reckon. But it's
I think the other thing we've also got to keep in mind is we are playing against some of the best defenders in the world.
Yeah.
So when we talk about, you know, chances not converted, sometimes there's a reason, because they've been blocked on the line, or the keeper's made an amazing save, or the woodwork stopped the ball going in. They're not necessarily because our strikers are not good enough. No. And I think it's really important to separate some of these things out, because I hear time and time again, you know, Brighton have lost, you know, X number of points from winning positions. It's the most stupid statistic in world football. You know, does it mean if you go ahead after 30 seconds in a game or 20 seconds, as Villa did last night, that they lost 3 points from a winning position? What utter nonsense. If you score a goal in injury time and there is literally 30 seconds left on the clock and then you concede in that 30 seconds,
Or 5 minutes and 30 seconds in Man United's case.
Or indeed that. Or indeed after the final whistle. I would accept that you have lost points from a so-called winning position. But going ahead after 20 seconds and Villa having 3 points from a winning position counted against them for last night is utter nonsense. So, you know, again, I think we have to be sort of very careful, A, with the use of those sort of statistics, but B, when we talk about, you know, our finishing this season, because we are up against some of the best defenders in the world. And that has to be recognised and that has to be taken into account in any situation.
It is taken into account, but there's only so much time you blame bad luck or bad finishing.
Good defending. I'll give you an example. Look at the attacking talent that Chelsea threw at us on Tuesday night. And what was it? Was it their attacking talent being so poor, or did our defenders have an absolutely superb game? I would argue that it was actually the latter. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that Chelsea have to go out and buy a whole bunch of new attackers. You know, they had some of the most exciting and expensive attacking talent on the pitch almost at once on Tuesday night. Similarly, against Manchester United, you know, did their amazing attacking talent fail for the largest part of that game, or did we defend very resolutely, very organised and very, very well? Again, I would argue it was the latter. So again, we just need to make sure that we don't all get kind of carried away that suddenly our attackers aren't good enough, because that's not the case.
Well, one thing is clear in that case, if the defenders that we're playing against are amongst the best, then I think that what's clear is that our midfielders are clearly amongst the best, because like I say, the disconnect between the quality and the style of play versus, and we do have to say this as fans, you know, maybe oversimplifying it, you know, the disconnect between the quality of the midfield play versus the finishing says to me that actually we've probably got arguably the, you know, one of the best midfields in the country.
Yeah, again, I think we've got to give ourselves a little bit of credit. Sometimes I think the one thing that we need to all do is kind of actually appreciate how far we've come in such a short space of time, but at the same time, recognize that we still have a lot of learning to do at this level. And game management, closing out games, finding ways of winning different ways at times are all part of playing at the top level. And some of the clubs that have been around this league a bit longer than us have kind of learned those tricks. We've also got one of the youngest squads in the league. So again, even though we as a club haven't been at this level for very long, some of our players have actually been in this level, at this level, for even less time. So there's a lot going on here in real time. And you know, one of the things I talked about last time I was on this programme was about how Graham is actually evolving the style of football at the same time as establishing himself as a coach at this level and learning about some of the teams that we're playing against and how to play against them. That's actually quite a trick to pull off, you know. And anyone that's coached football at any level will realise that changing the style of football is difficult enough without actually doing it with a young team in a league that the club is still relatively novices at playing in. So quite a feat to pull off.
It's fantastic. And I've enjoyed watching every single minute.
Brilliant.
It's been great. Now, Paul, I mean, obviously, we do have to talk to you about what the Albion roadmap looks like at the moment. Obviously, it was the FA Cup semi-finals at the weekend. Some fans were allowed back into Wembley. There's over 4,000, I think. So, I mean, what is the likelihood of actually having some people back in the Amex by the end of the season?
I think it's pretty good. I think we're looking at the Manchester City game being moved to midweek. I think that's already fairly public. We're looking at a potential capacity of 25%. There won't be away fans as part of that. That will be an opportunity for us to sort of scale up some of the things that we did for the test event, which seems like a lifetime ago now, and then the two league games that we had back in December. I think it was Southampton and Sheffield United, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Where we had 2,000 fans. So this is going to be almost four times the number of fans. There will be social distancing, there will be mask wearing, there will be medical questionnaires to complete in advance of the game. There may or may not be temperature checks. It depends on government policy at the time. But there won't be COVID passports required for next month's game. However, when we get back to August, the plan would be, again, assuming that the government's measures and markers have been met, is that we're looking at a near full capacity, if not full capacity. But what that will require is a very different regime. And of course, photo ID will be part of the game next month, but photo ID will absolutely be part of the regime for the start of the season. And almost certainly some form of COVID passport will be required. And if that isn't available because someone's pregnant or they've got a medical condition, which means they can't be vaccinated, then they would almost certainly have to have a negative test presentation a period before the game. And again, the government will determine what that is. So COVID passport, negative test, photo ID, digital ticket. Yes, it's going to be slower getting in. Yes, it's going to take a lot of getting used to for some people that this is the way it will be for some time to come, if not indefinitely. But in terms of getting back to full crowds, a relatively normal way of life, I think it's probably going to be a relatively small price to pay.
So is that an Albion thing?
It will be a league-wide. It will be a consistent league-wide policy. And by then, you know, we're hoping that away fans will be back because people will be able to move a lot more freely across the country. But I think, you know, we're looking at those measures with government as a means of getting as many fans back as quickly as possible, as safely as possible, protecting those that are still vulnerable, but at the same time, trying to make it as easy as possible for people to do that. And that's not easy because we're not allowed to hold medical data. So there's got to be a system which is live, but at the same time, not on our system. And we're in a position where we've also got to verify that the person holding that medical data in front of us is the person who is the correct ticket holder, is actually the person who we think they are. So photo ID then becomes an absolutely sort of unavoidable consequence when you've got a responsibility to do all of those things.
So could that be done via an app? So maybe you have it for certain like train tickets or various other things, you could have an app for this app, which is
I think one of the challenges, AD, over the next few months is just the speed and time that we have between now and then to get these things established and tested. So I suspect in the early days, it's going to be a combination of different things. You know, it'll be a digital season ticket. It will be photo ID in the normal way that we've all got some form of photo ID, perhaps apart from the kids. And then the NHS app will actually have a connection to those that have had the vaccination, and then will give you a green tick on your NHS app. It's a free app. It will download. It doesn't require a Wi-Fi connection. It actually will fire up in the way that the digital season ticket will fire up. So it doesn't. No one's got to worry about Wi-Fi at the stadium or anything like that, or even a great mobile reception on their phone. But we are moving to 5G in and around the stadium anyway, so we'll have far greater capacity at the stadium. But I think it will give everyone an opportunity to be able to move through the turnstiles as quickly as possible. But clearly, people are going to need to arrive earlier. They're definitely going to have to be patient. They're going to have to be respectful of each other, because some people are not going to be as adept with their phones as others. It's going to be different. But then going into Starbucks this morning was different. You know, it always is. You know, it's not the same as it was 12 months ago. Going into the supermarket is different. Just about every experience that we've had or are having or will have is different. And, maybe it won't be forever. Maybe it will. But either way, if we want to get back to full crowd sooner rather than later, we're going to have to go through a few hoops.
Do you have a date marker as to when the government might allow a full or near full capacity for next season?
Well, yeah, we're hoping really from the start, AD, to be honest, because if the roadmap goes according to the government's plan, then all restrictions will be lifted soon after June 21st. So it gives us an opportunity to bring people back at that time, hopefully in great numbers. The thing that I think is really, really significant about all of this is that if we can actually get people into the stadium in this manner quickly and safely, and people are comfortable to do that, then it will be another sign that life has kind of come back to normal. And I think that's a real confidence booster for everybody in their normal lives as well, because travel to football stadiums, travel to and from football stadiums, being in a football stadium, is one of those things people are thinking about, wow, you know, how can that be even possible in August? But I can tell you that back in April and May of last year, or April particularly, when the government were telling us that they were expecting us to be able to play football again in June or July, I just could not see that happening when 1,000 people a day were dying. In fact, I didn't even want to contemplate it. Sure. But the government scientists were very good with us in explaining that what we're seeing now is not actually what it's going to be like in 2 months from now, and definitely not what it's going to be like in 4 months from now. Yes, there will be a second wave, but we'll deal with that when it comes. In this scenario now, they're very clearly predicting for us at the moment, subject to any other issues arising between now and then, that come August, we should be in a position to have everyone back. And yeah, there will be some, as I say, there will be some pain, if you like, or some hoops to jump through, but hopefully not too many and not too badly.
I think that's basically on the back of a lot of people having gained weight during lockdown. Now, I mean, your point is valid about getting people into the stadium. And we've said this on the show before, you know, both myself and AD are very privileged to be in the stadium as part of the press pack. And we have to go up to the West Stand Upper. And for us, the West Stand Upper is this auditorium of debate and laughter and irony and anger,
misery,
and everything to do with it. And you're watching the game on the telly and you're watching the game beforehand, and it's this huge debating chamber. And at the moment, it's this horrible, empty, forlorn, lost, abandoned place. And it's almost a horrible place to go at the moment. I mean, you'd never thought you'd say that about the stadium. So the day that people come back will be, I think, almost as emotional as the first game at the Amex in 2011.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, it's going to be slightly ironic that it will be the 10th anniversary, give or take, of that first game at the stadium. So there's going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot of emotion, I think, flying around anyway. And a lot of people, of course, have been lost in not just the last 12 months, but over that decade. So there's a lot of emotion anyway. And I think it will be very special because, you know, one of the things I've always loved about working in football is this privilege that we all have of being able to wander around the stadium when it's empty. And, you know, for me, that has been sort of lost and ruined over the last year because, you know, it's like that on a match day. Mm. And I hate match days in an empty stadium. I absolutely detest them. And I can't wait to go back to a situation where I walk around the perimeter of the Amex on a match day and there's just thousands of people excited, you know, looking forward to the game with their families, with their friends, dressed in our colours. And that's special. And actually, we've lost that. The strange thing about Tuesday was that actually it was as close as I've been to a normal match day for a long time because there were literally thousands of Chelsea fans in their colours outside a football stadium. And it was for the wrong reasons. I mean, you couldn't make it up, you know, at the end of a year like we've had. And as I said, right at the start, it was one of the things that really annoyed me most about what happened, that it could not have been more ill-timed if they'd tried. You know, it was almost a slap in the face, not just to us, but to fans everywhere, not just because of what was being planned, but because of what fans have been through.
Yeah, but you mentioned there about, I mean, the empty stadiums and everything else. But it's also, you know, it's before you get to the stadium, it's the economy in the city. You know, I've been going to games, particularly last season, when it's in the middle of summer and it's blazing hot. And, you know, the pubs are normally full. You're playing Arsenal, you're playing Man City, you're playing Liverpool. You know, normally there's a buzz, there's an excitement in the city. There's a frisson and electricity. And, you know, you're coming through town and there's absolutely nothing. It's dead. You get to the ground and it's absolutely nothing. And it's like, you know, the economy suffered massively because of the COVID anyway. But on those, particularly those pubs and then around the station, which are full of colour and passion and like you said, excitement. To have that back it means so much, not just to the football club, but to the city itself and up and down the country for everyone in the same boat.
And every day that passes is a day closer to it happening.
Absolutely. And I hope that the vast majority of people will accept that it's not going to be as easy as it was to get in. But as I said before, life generally isn't as easy as it was before. So, you know, we've all got to adjust to that. And, you know, we've also as well got to protect our staff. You know, we're going to need a lot of people to move even 7,500 people in and out of the stadium next month because of what we've got to cope with in terms of entry. And then when it comes to August, we've got to move 30,000 people in and out. That's going to require a huge effort from our staff, and we've got to protect them. We've got to look after them, we've got to make sure they're safe. So a lot of these things that are being put in place are about as much about protecting each other in the stadium, fans and staff, as they are about complying with government guidelines. But all Premier League clubs are going to be subject to the same conditions. So, you know, we've got to get on with it.
Okay, and that's all we've got time for. So thank you, as ever, to the brilliant Paul Barber for your time. Thank you, of course, to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast. See you again next week. Thanks for listening. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Madman drums, bumbles, engines in the summer with a teenage diplomat.
you, mister. Told me I got what it takes. She said I turned you on, son, into something strong. Played a song with the funky break. And go-kart Mozart was checking out the weather charts, see if it was safe outside. And little early birdie came by in his curly whirly and asked me if I needed. She never got touched. She's gonna make it to the night. She's gonna make it through the night.
Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light. Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. In the night, through the mops of the ice, less than 5 breath. Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. With a spiral, please, and sneeze, and wheeze, and wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Now sky through the slingshot. shot down, but you never got touch. It's gonna make it through.